Hey gang, this is Xeonic Freak. This is our new podcast at the Cybernauts Cast. This is our first episode, which will be split into two parts with our Robert Woodhead interview. And it's pretty much just asking him a bunch of questions and harassing him and having a good old time. So this is part one of our Robert Woodhead interview, and coming soon will be part two, so hope you enjoy it.
Get ready.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Nameless Podcast. I am John Jones. With me are Xeonic Freak.
Howdy ho!
And Vimon Josh.
Greetings.
And Steve.
Yo.
And Amanda.
Hello.
And Green Consulting.
Hello.
And Robert Woodhead, our guest this week.
Good evening.
So I guess, Xeonic, do you have any questions for, Robert?
I've got quite a few. I guess we can do sort of a round table and harass him one question at a time. If Robert's cool with that.
Oh, I don't think I'll be too badly. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll just kind of start in the Skype chat. We'll start with Josh. Josh, do you have any, what's your first question for Robert?
I would say my first question, hold on, let me get the, I guess my first question would be, how easy or hard was it back in, well, to license anime back in the day, like back when there was little to no market here in the U.S., so.
Well, in the very earliest days when we were doing first licenses, it was impossible. I mean, the Japanese companies that we talked to just had no real experience doing anything with the U.S. market, and so they just didn't know how to proceed. The first time that I tried when I was over in Japan, I actually went over to do a computer convention, and as a favor, the guy running the convention, a guy named Toshio Okada, who was one of the founders of Gainax, got me some meetings with various production companies to see if I could get licenses. And at the end of the week, I was very discouraged because I hadn't been able to really get anywhere. And I was having dinner with him and complaining to him about this. And he said something that I felt was very insightful. He said, everybody wanted to be this person to do business with me, and that turned out to be the case. Our initial license actually wasn't with a Japanese company; it was with the US brand of Fuji Sankei. But once we had our first product out, then it became much easier to get the actual Japanese based companies to deal with us. And after we got the first title out from a Japanese-based company, which was Riding Bean, then the floodgates opened, because now that there was sort of was a precedent of how to do it, and everybody was talking to everybody else, and they'd learned that we actually paid advances and paid royalties. And from then on, it became just very straightforward.
Cool. What's the next question, Steve?
What I'd like to ask something, you know, on the lines of, you know, Robert being a big Eve online figure in the political circles. Just how did you get involved, you know, into the political race, as far as Eve Online was concerned?
Well, it actually sort of happened by accident. At the time I first ran, I was actually getting very discouraged by some things that I saw going on in the game, and I was pretty much planning on quitting. But I decided that I had a few things to say before I went, and the forums on EVE Online can be, you know, very abrasive. And if I just wrote down what I wanted to say in the forums, I would just get trolled, and it would be just a waste of effort. So instead, I decided to use running for the Council of Stellar Management, which is the player advisory group of EVE, as a way just to, you know, say my piece. I had no expectation of getting elected, and quite frankly, when I got the email from CCP saying I had been elected, I thought I was being punked, and I was deeply suspicious. And in fact, and I didn't really, really believe it until they paid for the plane tickets to go to Iceland.
Wow.
Yeah. So what were some of the changes? I've only played EVE Online like the 14-day trial, and I gave up after 7 because it was just way too much work for me to spend that much time. But what were some of your complaints you had with the game when you went to say things about it?
Originally, I had two big concerns. One was the problem that their servers were getting overloaded. They were suffering from a huge amount of lag when they had very, very large fleet fights. I mean, EVE is a game where effectively everybody is on the same server. And the way it works is it's not like, you know, World of Warcraft where you have like 6,000 or 7,000 accounts on one realm and then there's another realm that is totally separate. In EVE, everyone is in the same universe and they have this just cluster supercomputer in England that runs the game. And basically, every time you jump into a new star system using a Stargate, you're effectively, it's just like doing a realm transfer in World of Warcraft. You're going you're moving between computers on the cluster. So the entire game communicates with the entire rest of the game, and they were having fleet fights of where 700 or 800 people were all jumping into the same system to have this huge battle, and the server couldn't keep up. And I had some things to say about how that could be possibly solved. The other point was that I felt that the user interface for EVE was very outdated and was a great hindrance to broader acceptance of the game. And so I had some things to say about that. Interestingly enough, over the past 2 years that I've been on the council, CCP has done a huge amount of work on both of those issues. I'm not saying it's because of what I said by any stretch of the imagination. I think that they recognize these issues too. But EVE has become a much more interesting accessible game than it was when I first got started. And, you know, if you want to play in a hardcore PvP MMO, there's just nothing that comes close to the depth and complexity of EVE, and especially the social complexity. I mean, you just can't. I mean, a large raid guild on WoW would be considered a bunch of noobs in EVE, where you can often have, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 players in a single alliance.
So is it easier to kind of start up EVE without being really overwhelmed with like all these high level people? Because that's how it was for me when I played it for like a week. Like, but this was 6 years ago, I think, when the last time I touched this game.
Yeah, I mean, For me, I think the biggest obstacle to getting going in EVE is that it's sometimes hard to get yourself plugged into a social group. I mean, if you survive 90 days in the game, you'll be probably addicted for a long time, and that is entirely correlated with how fast you find a group of players who basically adopt you. I mean, I would have quit after about 3 weeks myself if I hadn't been basically randomly adopted one day by a group of other players. And I'm still in contact with these people today.
Nice. Cool. David, do you have a question for Robert?
Yeah. So with a lot of the problems that the anime industry is facing today, like all the lawsuits, you know, against 4Kids or against ADV or what replaced ADV anyway. And yeah, with Funimation controlling as much as they do, do you think it's still possible for other other companies to compete with Funimation? Is there still a future for other companies, or is it just going to be dominated by Funimation at this point?
I don't really think I'm in a position to answer that question. I mean, Animego has always, for better or worse, sort of specialized in not doing what everybody else was doing. I think that's one of the reasons we didn't get as big as some of the other companies, and it's also some of the reasons why we didn't curl up and die like some of the other companies did. We've always tried to find new and interesting things to do to try and zig when everybody else was zagging. That strategy, as well as the strategy of being very conservative about the choices we make, has kept us around for over 20 years now. Right now, for example, we have not done any anime in several years, although we just released a couple of Hello Kitty videos.
Right, which was
quite that's a perfect example. These videos are 10 years old and lots of people have passed on them, but we saw an opportunity we thought the idea of Hello Kitty educational videos for little children was a hilarious idea to give a try. And we were able to get a license for it. It took us over a year to get that license, but they're out now and they're doing very well.
Say, Robert, is licensing's now getting a little bit better to get now than it was, like, say, when ADV was, like, monstering their way across the board of everybody? I remember it was at the point where where we used to be able to negotiate it at that point, there was ADV came in and it just kind of, we're taking this here now. So, but it was just ridiculous. I mean, I just love the whole thing about Evangelion. It's like... But anyway, I just always wondered, is the licensing getting better now that the economy is changing? I mean, because I remember some of the offers they gave you, you were like looking at them going, you're not seriously considering asking that much. It's just, yeah, those were days, like I said.
That's just business. If somebody else is willing to pay more for a license, then I think that's worth it. And my advice to licensors has been take the money and don't give them anything and check the players. My attitude is I and my wife we look at possible licenses and say, is this something to do? Is this something to enjoy working on? And how much can we do? Can we pay? How much do we think the sales is going to be? If we can make a deal, we can't move on.
Robert, I think a robot took over your voice there for a second.
Hold on. It's a bandwidth issue is what it is.
Oh, really?
Yes. Something on the line there.
Is this better?
That's
perfect. Oh, yes.
That is much better, yes.
Yes, I
I have a very strange USB mic, and just every once in a blue moon, it goes like that. Always when I'm saying something profound, I think.
Yeah.
And then I just have to replug it, and it's fixed for the next couple of days. It's really annoying.
Yeah.
Robo Woodhead coming to a theater near you.
Sorry about that. I hope it was still audible.
Yeah, I think it'll work. Yeah, I was going to say something about what Green said about the... I actually got like a $10 of Evangelion. That thing's like $200 now. And it's probably worth more because I had Spike Spencer sign it at NashiCon, I guess. But yeah, that's one of those series that's going to... It's on its way to becoming really expensive and collectible, like Sailor Moon. And Utena is like the same way now, but it's going to be re-released. So whatever's on eBay that's priced a lot, it's going to go down in price eventually. Now I have my question. Let's see. Okay, my first one was... Okay. My question, Robert, is how did the name Anime Ego came to be? Or really, how did the business start? But I guess you kind of explained that. But I was just kind of wondering, like, how did you come up with a name for the company?
Oh, that was my idea. And it was just just plugging together, you know, two words, anime and ego, which is Japanese for English, in... you know, sticking them together in a cute way. That it's apparently called a manto is the technical linguistic term for those kind of constructions. But by the way, I didn't know it was called a portmanteau until about 5 years ago.
But at that time, we're kind of like, oh, I'll just roll with it. Worked for
well,
us.
It sounded like a cute name, you know?
It worked.
Yeah. I mean, we weren't thinking about those sort of issues too hard back then because the company was basically started as a joke, as a fun weekend thing to do, and haha, maybe we'll actually make some money. And, you know, we didn't expect it to, and we didn't expect it to be anything more than a hobby. And it just sort of kind of mutated from that.
That's my fault.
And to this day, I mean, you guys are still pretty much there in the top five as far as anime and Sentai distributors.
I really couldn't tell you. I mean, we.
No, I actually went out there and took a look on the census, and on a couple of places, you guys are still up there in the top five list.
Interesting. I mean, I actually don't worry too much about things we've done in the past. I concentrate more on the projects we're currently working on because that's the interesting part. You know,
that was one of the things that was one of the things I was going to be asking about. Are you allowed to go ahead and mention anything coming up?
Well, the thing that I'm currently working on right now is something that's it's not a real secret, is that we're releasing Lone Wolf and Cub on Blu-ray, and I have
nice.
Done yeah, it's going to come out this fall, and I'm actually redoing the subtitles for it now. Because Blu-ray subtitles give you more flexibility than DVD subtitles, so I decided I wanted to go back and do another pass on them because the different limitations and restrictions mean that I can make different choices about, you know, how we translate some things, and we also took our HD transfers and had them digitally noise reduced. And this, I got this wonderful piece of software that does it. It takes like 4 days per movie on a high-end workstation to do the job, but it generates just absolutely stunning picture quality. So we're working on that. We're investigating a couple of the licenses, but I can't really talk about them because we don't talk about that sort of stuff.
That's cool. That's a given right there.
Until the license is signed and we have the materials in house and we know we can actually release it, we don't say anything because we don't want to disappoint people.
Right. Well, I've got one other question.
I guess it answers my next question then.
Oh, I was going to ask really quick. Amanda, go ahead, Steve.
No. Let Amanda ask her question.
Yeah, she needs to do all the talking.
Well, actually, I was going to ask if there are any plans to release Bubblegum Crisis on Blu-ray.
You read my mind, Amanda.
There goes one of my questions.
Yes.
because it's been out in Japan on Blu-ray for several years now, and I've heard it's absolutely gorgeous, and I've just been curious if there are any plans to release that in the States or not.
It's something that we're considering. The issue is, first of all, Bubblegum Crisis was a 16 millimeter. It was filmed in 16 millimeter, and even though a Blu-ray release would be better than the current DVD transfers, I'm wondering if it would be enough better that. That you can deal with, but it's a question of how expensive would it be to get it to the level of quality that I would be comfortable releasing. And the other aspect is that Blu-ray releasing is still considerably expensive, much more so than releasing and pressing DVDs. So you have to be really, really careful to be able to, know that you're going to have enough sales to recoup your expenses.
Uh-huh.
That's why our first release on Blu-ray was Shogun Assassin, because we knew that would do really well. And it would give us a baseline in terms of, the difference between the DVD sales and the Blu-ray sales to make calls about other titles. And based on that, we're doing Lone Wolf and Cub, which, of course, is the Japanese version of Shogun Assassin. But it's our top-selling subtitle series. Based on that, then I might have some metrics to judge whether or not something like Bubblegum Crisis could get released. But Bubblegum Crisis is an older series, and
it's still a classic.
It's a classic, I agree, and it's the sort of thing, the artistic person in me says, yes, I would really love to do that, because I would like to go back and revisit the translation and the subtitling we did one more time to see what we could do to improve it. That's one aspect of it. But the business aspect of it is,
right.
I don't want to lose 50 grand doing it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I was going to say, if regarding the quality, you are going to, if you were to do that, you would change the quality of the dub, right? Or would you keep it the same?
Don't do that.
Come now. The dub isn't that bad.
Yeah,
I mean, for its
time. I'm not touching that subject.
Yeah,
I prefer the subtitles overall myself, especially where it came to the soundtrack.
In my defense, I have most of those songs that someone ripped off and put on YouTube in the English subtracks, as this English sub track on my iTouch, because I'm like, when I first listened to it, I was like, God, this is really bad. But then after a while, I'm like, this isn't so bad. It's kind of like, it just gels well together, even though it's not that great. And see, Steve fails to understand my logic and listening to some of the English songs. Some of them aren't that bad. And some of them are just really bad.
I wiped enough blood from my ears and my eyes. I'm sorry.
You've threatened some remarks to me about me liking that soundtrack, and we won't go back down that path again.
Honestly, I was glad that Animega was the one to go ahead and pick that license and release it out as a subtitled strictly subtitled back then. A friend of mine had actually turned me on to it from Laserdisc. His father worked for General Dynamics and had the opportunity to work on a contract overseas in Japan, and had brought Bubblegum Crisis and some Urusei Yatsura on over. I was just over there and he's all like, "Hey, Steve, come check this out." And I'm like, "Well, what's this?" And, he popped in Bubblegum Crisis, and I'm just like, wow, because it took me back to, series like, Gatchaman, Space Cruiser Yamato, the classics, Captain Harlock, things of that nature. And, that's when... I came by when I finally came across Animago, and back in 93, 94, was that when? Yeah, I think that's when I came by. I came by your table,
yes,
back then, because that was because me and my wife were getting married the very next day, and I had to go ahead and make sure that I grabbed something from Con. Yeah. That was going to be worthy and redeemable. And Bubblegum Crisis was that item.
Yes.
See, I guess, Robert, regarding... I was going to say, regarding the offset cost of bringing Bubblegum Crisis to Blu-ray in America, you could always do, a release of 500 and just give 3 or 4 of those copies to us, because we would definitely buy those off of you in a heartbeat.
Yes, absolutely.
I have a 16-year-old I can go ahead and trade for you. He does Windows.
I've already got one. Well, I got a 17-year-old. I don't need an extra one.
Oh, come on. We can do the whole Egyptian marriage thing, the whole Egyptian marriage contract thing and everything, Think about it.
You just want to be literally...
Okay, but back to questions.
Yeah, we need to start harassing with questions again.
Amanda, you have the floor. I apologize.
Actually, that was my main question.
Did you have any others? Because I kind of want to make up and how we kind of treated you during the Bubblegum Crisis review, which I apologize for.
My mind went blank, so let me think of something while you guys are asking your question.
Okay, Green, do you have anything?
Not much. As I was thinking, I was going to ask Robert, what happened after we got the game going for Bubblegum Crisis with Michael Pondsmith? How did that actually work out for you guys on your side? Because I know Michael decidedly started going from doing board games to games he went to working on his computer games after a while. And everything, but I remember a lot of people asked me about the game and if you were going to be able to do anything on that for that game, and I said I have no clue. That's up to Robert.
Boy, I haven't thought about that in a long time. To be honest, I couldn't really tell you too much. It was so long ago.
Yeah.
I know that I never had any real inclination to. Do any game work on that. It was just not where I was at the time.
Yeah, I remember we put a lot into keeping that going between, I know Michael was trying to keep in contact with you, and there was a lot because you were still going between where you guys are now and Japan, and you were just finally moving back, and I was going between the two conventions back and forth. It was lots of things for the both of you guys and such, and things, I think there's miscommunications at one point where it almost fell apart, and we got that back together. And then we wanted to see about, I think you actually looked into some more games. It's just saying, I'd have loved to find out if we could actually have gotten more of the other games out, like the Gundam ones and such, at some point over here to be translated. But a lot of that market has changed now, at least for the computer stuff now. So it's like,
Stuff happens. I mean, it would have been nicer if it had worked out a little bit better than it did. But, sometimes things just don't work out.
I don't know. I mean, I remember back in the day, And by back in the day, I mean, you know, in the last 8 years. Playing teenagers from going ahead, actually doing cross platforms between Bubblegum Crisis, the RPG, and Teenagers from Outer Space.
Well, it's still being played at the conventions. I mean, we had
For DunderCon,
there was like 7 games of it going on. People were, and everybody, and people remember me as working with Michael for doing it. And I said I had nothing to do was write the game, but I, you know, what you ever need and everything. But a lot of people were like, "Hey, can you run this?" I said, "I never even got to play it." You know, I have a copy of it. I paid.
Well, I don't.
I'll get Michael to send you. He still has some.
Well, back
you ever got a copy of it?
If I ever got a copy, it got lost. I mean, stuff piles up, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't go by it, which people would drop by the booth for you. I mean, the gifts that people would drop by. I think you left with more things that you than you brought sometimes.
Sometimes. But always unintentionally.
True. I know. Those ashtrays.
When RPG came out, I was gratified. You know, with it, because I mean, for a number of years we had gone ahead and actually used the Palladium system, and using parts of the Robotech franchise to go ahead and get the roles with the Cyclones and such, and using the armor stats for the hard suits. And when the RPG came out, it just opened up a whole new, side of our imagination and the recesses of our subconsciouses, and we just went to town on it.
So you could just kind of like kick the other game away, like forget that game. The real game just came out.
Well, people make a lot of hybrids of games. They'll take what works in the game, and they'll take and put what's and then take the rules and move it around a lot. And they'll bring things over. It's like some people will take, like, you know, you heard, you know, an AD&D variant, and what's the variant? Well, they're taking this other rule from another game and putting it in. And we have, like, one of the ones I like to do is Ardwin, and Ardwin is really kind of destructive, a lot of people think, but it's not. It's a multiverse game that was written by a man who just was really cool, and put it in was things like cyberpunk, and then you get this twisted game of magic and everything, and goes, oh well, that's this. And I'm going, well, no, it's a little bit different. But you take Bubblegum Crisis and the stuff that came out, people were like really cool. But I mean, I was using the Bubblegum Crisis stuff, but I was using elements and things from like Appleseed for the weaponry, yeah, you know, from the mangas and such. And people like, why are the weapons in your game much better? I said, because I'm not using the ones in the game. I'm using these games.
And that's not considered cheating, or is it?
No. That's
the great thing about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. No, it's not considered cheating.
Yeah. Just being just taking a thing and just changing it there. I mean, it's not like I'm saying I'm the only one with the guns. I'm saying this is what's available now in this universe because I'm adapting this into it. And it made better sense for harder weaponry and such. I would have liked to see if it had actually kept going. I mean, I was talking with Michael and saying instead of just playing it as a book game, take the hypertext language, put it into a web page based CD-ROM, put it in your machine and let it come up and bring all your information in front of you on a laptop. Well, at that time, you probably had maybe 20 laptops in an entire convention of about 3,000 people. Now it's like probably, you know, it's equal 1-to-1. Everybody has some sort of device now in front of them. And the games could be so much different now, especially anime-based games, because you could actually have stuff where you could have the Japanese cyberpunk or the Bubblegum Crisis stuff, and you could have like intercut stuff that would actually, you know, with music and things like that would interact with the people doing the board portion of the game. And I think about you, Robert, because I mean, your history with games and such, it's just, you know, that's where I knew you from when I realized Yeah, if you, my profile picture is that picture of me, of you, and Michael House from the first convention. It was like, wait a minute, Robert Wood, Wizardry, oh, and I almost fell on the floor and started groveling at you once I realized this is the person that I knew was like, you know, my hero. It made people, that when I told people, this is what the history, this is the future of computers. And they looked at me and said, it's just a game. No, it's more than a game. Yeah, it's like,
that's the future.
Yes, yes. So it's like, that was a kind of a pinnacle weekend to meet Robert when I did. And it was because of Michael House, who's gone off to be a hermit somewhere in Japan, I think, or he's translating now, I think, isn't he, Robert? Still over there, but he's not doing anime anymore.
To be honest, I haven't heard from him in several years.
Yeah,
but the last I heard, he was over there still doing, you know, strange translating things.
Yeah, he wasn't doing anime anymore. Actually, said he actually supposedly he hates anime. He went on a 10-hour rant to a friend of mine about anime. I'm like, Michael House doesn't like anime? This is like, I thought it was a joke, but it's
must have been like recently or something, because I could kind of see that.
No, it was about, this is about more than 5 years ago or more that I had this confirmed, and he's doing business translations now, but not in person.
That's like going ahead and saying Peter Payne's going to go ahead and sell J-List and become a sanitation worker.
Probably. I mean, it's just, I mean, I met him while we were doing some anime room for the gaming convention about 4 months before AnimeCon 91. And he was like in the room translating verbatim as everybody was speaking. So he could actually, he was like translating instantly. It's like, whoa, this guy's cool. Yeah. So we're like sitting here watching this stuff, and he started talking, and we kept in contact. And then he contacts me about at the convention and says, before the con, and says, Carl Horn can't make it. Can you come and help us work the booth? I said, sure. That was like, you know, I get to meet Robert and everything, and that was really cool because I've been promoting like the videos you had out at the time, Maddox,
Melskin Panic,
yeah, Melskin Panic, and there was
go ahead, sorry, George,
yeah, it wasn't B now, but I can't remember, it was Maddox and one of the others. We've been promoting those all over the Central Valley and having shows. And so it was like, I get to meet the man. You know, I had already met Carl Masick before at one of the other conventions, and I realized, Carl's nice, but, you know, this is Robert. I want to meet Mr. Woodhead. Yes. And it's like, then we sit there that whole weekend trying to, you know, getting swamped by selling all those cells.
Yeah, I've got to go ahead.
I have a cell. Oh, my goodness.
I have some of those still.
Oh,
I still have a bunch of mine.
Carl, though.
Believe it or not, we finally sold out of our last cells a couple months ago.
Except the ones were on your wall.
Well, I still have my personal collection, but the ones we were selling.
Oh, that's your personal collection.
Yeah. Well, they had all of the bubblegum crash at AnimeCon 91. I think most of them had backgrounds, some of them didn't, but it was like, I think it was, we had them actually, we priced them and we had no clue at that point. Roberts set a price and then later on found out, no, that should have been much higher. They're all bubble, they're great price, they're great ones. Whoa. Too.
Well, I know, I got them for free, so.
It was all,
yeah, I can't really complain there. I know on eBay, like somebody's trying to sell crash sales all the time. And I'm like, I don't know.
Well, these all had backgrounds, the one I had. They're really nice.
Yeah, most of those are like the same Nene and Pris Hardsuit designs. And I think it's probably coming from the same guy, whoever that person is.
I think mine's are mostly villains, the ones I have.
Well, the only main villain that's worth not really worth anything, was Largo 2.0.
That's the guy that was the Terminator big guy, yes. I had the one that's on the subway.
Actually, speaking of cells, I picked up a Riding Bean one from Animazement last year. Ooh. It's Percy and Dick, like, where they were like going over the footage in that one scene. And they're like, yeah, we got the Bean Bin, and all right. And they're both like grinning at each other. Mm-hmm. I got that for like $30 at, I think, Amanda, you told me who the guy got it from, or their website or something.
And oh geez, I'm forgetting now.
Yeah, you told me the site, but yeah, I think I checked it like
anime. It was Asylum Anime.
Okay. Oh. I actually checked the website like a month later and it was still listed on their site, so like who knows when they're gonna update that.
They're usually better about updating than that.
Oh. They probably have now, but I guess for questions, Josh, does he have anything else?
The only other question I have is, what's your opinion on the current anime industry?
Oh, I think the best answer I could give is a more broader one is what is the state of the general foreign films business in the United States, and we're going through some tough times, definitely. It's a combination of several things. The recession hasn't helped, of course. There's also, we're in a transitional period between physical distribution, DVDs and Blu-rays, and electronic distribution. And the problem is that the mechanisms for making money by electronic distribution are just not mature yet. And, we've got some of our stuff that's available on iTunes and other places that you can, pay a small fee and watch it on your iPad. But the income that's generated from that is a fraction of what you get by releasing on DVD. And yet, there's a definite trend of, the DVD market is, faster and faster shrinking. We're getting squeezed from a variety of directions. Price points are going down. I mean, I remember those lovely days when we could sell a single 45-minute OVA on VHS tape for $40. I mean,
To the world of a 12-year-old kid, that was like a month's worth of allowance.
It was.
Yeah.
True, but you can understand that when you have that sort of price point, you can say, well, gee, if we sell 2,000 of these, we'll break even. Okay? Which means you can justify releasing a lot of titles that would otherwise not get out. I mean, if right now, release a new samurai film, it retails for $20. And of course, because of distribution expenses, the company gets a fraction of that. And still has to pay for the advertising and all of the overhead costs and the costs of actually producing the DVDs and the costs of doing all the pre-production work. So the margins are very thin, and you can't pay big advances, and that limits the amount of titles you can release. And sometimes you just can't afford to take the risk on a title you think would sell really well, but the advance is just too high, and you just have to say no, I can't pay this. So that is constraining the choices that companies like ours can make in terms of what we would like to do, and there's what we can justify doing. And it used to be in the early days, if we wanted to do it, we usually were able to, almost always were able to get a price where we could like make some money. Or at least fool ourselves into believing we're going to break even. These days, that's much tougher.
All right, Steve, what's your next question?
Honestly, on a side note, I'd like to know, what would be the possibilities of. And you know what? I just drew a blank. Wow. There is
You want me to go ahead of you and let you think about it?
You know what? I have an idea. Ask him your question about Bao.
No, I'm gonna no. I'm saving Bao to the end.
Yeah. All right.
Those are my serious questions.
Okay.
But my next question is, I know that Robert, you worked in the game industry in the 80s, and especially worked on with Wizardry. My question was, how was the game industry, or I guess when you started with PC gaming, how was that like, and working on Wizardry and everything?
Well, that was basically the Dark Ages. I mean, Wizardry was basically written by myself and Andy Greenberg, and you know, we were basically, he was still a graduate student at Cornell, and I'd been actually thrown out of Cornell for a year for grades and was sleeping on my mother's couch. And of course, the low grades was because I was messing around on computers too much, but that's another story. You know, it's basically, you know, the two guys in the garage type of thing. In those early days, the companies were very small. They were often like independent programmers with small companies actually doing the distribution. And, you know, it was quite possible for, you know, just a couple of people to get together and release a game and make a go of it. Mm-hmm. Until recently, that sort of business model just evaporated, and you had games that cost $50 or $60 million to produce, and hundreds of people are working on it. You know, they're basically were movies. One of the interesting things that's happened over the past 3 or 4 years is smartphones and iPads, because now, once again, there's a distribution model and a market for you know, sort of indie films, games. You know, small group of people get together and do a game, and they've got a way to sell it, and they've got a way to hopefully make some money at it, and they can do, you know, sort of the kind of games that we were doing back in the day in terms of, you know, relatively small games, but definitely with a, you know, sort of personal style to them, and that's very encouraging, and I think a very healthy thing, because it means that you know, the couple of guys in the garage can once again get out there and you know, be creative. But the early days were a lot of fun. I mean, we were making it up as we were going along, we weren't worrying too much about how things were going. I mean, I didn't think that Wizardry was going to be the success that it was. I didn't really care. I mean, I wrote the game because I thought it was something interesting to do. And I had a lot of fun doing it. And then all of a sudden it started selling like crazy, and which was wonderful. I mean, the way I try to explain it to people is that I don't use my own words. I use Steve Martin's words, because Steve Martin was once asked about comedy, and he said, the best thing about comedy is I get paid for doing this. Of course, he said it better. I get paid for doing this. But it's true. I mean, you know, I would have written Wizardry my biggest hope when I released the game was that it would make enough money to pay off my student loans, and it did that the first month. So, it was all gravy.
Like I have said, you created, because your game and the home computer hit the market at about the same time. Really, the good computers, the Ataris, the 64s, and then the early PCs, and then the Macs, and everything, the original Apples, and everything like that. You were at the right place, and that was the cool thing about it.
Well,
I wanted to add
a huge amount of luck. There was a huge amount of luck. I mean, Wizardry was just one in a sort of continuum of games, starting with paper and pencil role playing. a lot of really innovative computer games on a system called Plato that both Andy and I used a lot. Plato basically was the place where everything you love about the internet was invented in the early 1970s. It does not get nearly as much credit as it should, but it's where multiplayer gaming started. It's where forums started. It's where chat started. It's where multi-user chat started. It's where email, really got its push. Desk accessories were invented on Plato. It was 10 years, 15 years ahead of its time. And like dozens of people came out of Plato and went on to do interesting and fun things. One of the founders of Lotus was a Plato guy. Silas Warner, Castle Wolfenstein, he was a Plato guy. And Wizardry was just our way of saying, I wonder if we can do something similar on this tiny little home computer, and what can we do to take advantage of the capabilities that it has? And then other people saw what we did, and they added their own twist to it, and the whole genre evolved. So I don't look at it in terms of, of it being an important creation. I think it was just sort of, it was a transitional form in the evolution of this art form, and it was no more or less important than things that came before and the things that came after. It added a few twists of its own, and other people then riffed on that, and that's how these things evolve and change over time. And I think that's a very good and healthy thing. And if people like the game, great. I got a lot of fun out of writing it, and I wouldn't have traded it for anything.
I was going to add to the regarding when you mentioned the indie scene. I've got a buddy of mine who's CEO of Mighty Rabbit Studios, which his game of Saturday Morning RPG just came out this past month. I'm not sure if you've heard about it or not.
No, but, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's out on the Apple market right now, but it's eventually going to be to like Steam and the Android market later this year. But he's kind of, this is something he's absolutely wanted to do, and he's got his own game out. It's apparently popular around the world except for the United States for some reason. Yeah, like he's going to be interviewed for like this UK magazine coming up soon and regarding for mobile games. And he's like ecstatic over that, but he's trying to get the money to be able to justify everything he's worked on for the past year and a half. So I think he'll pull it off. But yeah, you should definitely check that out if you have an Apple device. It's the first episode's free. It's like a Saturday morning cartoon, but in RPG format.
Well, that's a very interesting idea.
Yeah, I was with him at the East Coast Game Conference last week, and I kind of pretended that I was part of the company. And people were like, "Are you with them?" I'm like, "Well, I am now for the next couple hours until the real people get back." And I'm just kind of like showing people around like how to do stuff in the game. I completely fib my way through that, and everyone was cool with me. No one cared. That's how I roll.
You stole one of my lines.
Which one?
Oh, he says, "Are you his Animago?" "Yes, I'm actually Robert Woodhead, but I'm actually his evil twin."
"I'm Robert Woodhead for the next 20 minutes.
I got away with that at Worldcon because I went there for Robert. I had worked with Ro Adams at that one. It was real fun. Speaking of Ro, where is he these days? Is he still with us? And
Yeah, he's. I believe he's in New York right now. These days he hasn't been doing stuff with Animego for about 10 years now.
Yeah,
and I occasionally hear from him. He's gone through some tough times, but I think he's back on his feet now.
That's good.
Yeah, well, I worked with him for a very long time. He was the scenario designer for Wizardry 4, and it was during that work when he was basically living with me and working on that that Animago got started. So it was sort of his idea.
Yeah, yeah, he was really cool. We were communicating off and on about different anime, and then his email address went offline and we lost contact and everything. And it was about 10 years ago and such and everything. But I hadn't bothered you because I knew you were busy with some things. And then I got busy with a lot of life doing computer security work and such. I haven't really done much conventions at all. Are you still doing any of them? Is Animeco still doing any of them? Any of the conventions?
No, we haven't gone to a convention in quite some years. The reason is that our focus really shifted to the Samurai films, and there really wasn't, other than occasionally going to Comic-Con, there really wasn't anything that was cost-effective. And then Comic-Con just got like too hideously expensive that it just wasn't worth it.
Yeah, I understand that one. I kind of think that some of the conventions have kind of lost their enamor that what they were there for. I mean, we knew at 90 AnimeCon.
Yeah. George, this is a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
we kind of debated the point of these larger conventions have actually lost touch with what the conventioner is looking for and wants to experience.
Yeah, I mean, when AnimeCon 91 and Anime Expo started, it was about getting anything that wasn't here in the U.S. and everything. And that was really one of those things that everybody, you know, they saw that and they said, you know, this is what's going on. Now it's like half the stuff is already here in the U.S. We've lost a lot of vendors. We lost the people that brought in a lot of the things, but it's here now. Most people can find the things that were hard to find. But the conventions, I think, lost it because we didn't see as many of the really needed guests and stuff like that. I mean, I liked going to conventions. I enjoyed it. Not that I had to really see much of them. usually because I was here running doing the things for the fans.
Right.
And everything. But, you know, Expo kept moving back and forth. I was like, they're not going to stick around for long.
You see, in my opinion, Comic-Con and Anime Expo have taken it up to, it's more for, industries and not so much for the fans.
Right. Oh, yeah. I agree. But then again, look at what's left of the industry. I mean, Robert and us, we go there, we see these, remember how massive the dealers were in the beginning. And it was like, we have people like, AD Vision creating these giant booths around the things that in such and like, what are they, you know, they're treating it like Comic-Con, in the industry side. And Comic-Con jumped on the anime bandwagon really fast when they saw it was really taking off. And the people who run Comic-Con, I'm not saying they're all for the industry, more or less for the fan and less for the fans. It isn't as friendly as it was in the past.
No, I'll agree, and that's where we agree. They've kind of lost sight. Mm-hmm. They've kind of strayed from the path.
Yeah, and the thing is, it isn't the industry that funds these conventions either. It's the people who go to them, and that's the fans.
Right.
I mean, you have science fiction conventions and things like that. I mean, we go back to, you know, the first Trek cons, and then you got the fantasy book conventions and things like that. I mean, I'm with a lot of the people who run the Bay Area conventions, and these people are like the who's who of science fiction and fantasy. I end up at going to, you know, people's houses and realizing, oh wait, this is, you know, Mirenson Bradley over here was, you know, Paul Anderson and all these, and these are people that are like going, hi George, and I'm like, okay, it's like I've known these people for like, you know, many years and such like that, and they go and pass away, and I'm like at their houses. It's just those people understand it's about the people who come to conventions, and they're the lifeblood. Anime conventions are losing that because the industry is changing. It was the economy. I mean, we had a Borders. We had a Borders in town here that actually outdid all the other Borders in selling manga because they were just the right spot. But when they closed, that section was the first section to go because people just hit it. And it shows that there's still a huge market for the anime stuff. 2002, 2003, he says, I'm not doing any booths anymore. I'm just, you know, bringing stuff here. He says, I'm not going to compete against the people buy my product to sell in their stores. And, you know, but that didn't work. Obviously that didn't work out for him either. Yeah. So like I said, I've been part of a lot of this beforehand. I was promoting anime before there was an anime fandom and everything. And then a lot of the American companies came along and I started promoting them to bring more, so they'd have more customers to bring in more anime. That's why I loved about those conventions. Those the fun things is talking with the fans, especially when we put out the Macross box set, Robert. Those are, you know, people still want to come to my house and steal them. I said, go buy them.
Well, they'll have a hard time buying them now.
Yeah, I know. They're gone now.
Yeah.
I told them, I said, go. Someone somewhere is going to, you know, sell off their kids' their anime collection. Just like the comic book collection. You sold off my what? That was anime. Hey, I still have my Orange Road box set, the laser box set you gave me for my wedding gift.
Wow. Yeah.
What a good guy.
Yeah, that was a nice one. He was nice. I had to carry those back on the airplane if it was me. And it's like, you want to put those on the overhead? No, I'm holding them right here.
I don't trust your kind of quality of airlines for these box sets. I will hold on to them, good ma'am.
I can imagine going through that now with the TSA and everything.
Yeah, they probably want to like put through x-rays and like do a weapon scan search and like, it's not even nothing left. I'm like, screw you, TSA.